Good afternoon. It is a Thursday, April the 5th, 2018, 14 coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears with you for the duration of the afternoon today. Do want to do some quick housekeeping. Want to thank Barry Farber for coming on last hour, conservative talk show pioneer. It's always fun to talk and debate and just discuss things with Barry. So I want to thank Barry Farber for coming on last hour. And I do want to remind you that coming up on Tuesday, April the 17th, between 5:10 and 6 p.m., one of the front runners in the Democratic primary for governor here in Ohio, Dennis Kucinich, former Fox News commentator as well as candidate in the primary for president, former Ohio State representative for many years, former mayor of Cleveland. Dennis Kucinich will be live in studio on Tuesday, April the 17th, 5:10 to 6 p.m. I will have him here to interview him, but here's the unique thing. You will be able to call in and talk with him and ask your questions 5:10 to 6 p.m., Tuesday, April the 17th. Telephone number 740-383-9944. Or if you want to send me a question that you would like me to ask Representative Kucinich when he is here, do that before April 17th by sending me an email at scott@wwgh1071.com, and we'll ask him on the air 5:10 p.m. on April 17th. That's a Tuesday. Scott@wwghradio1071.com. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun because we're going to remember a man who spent some time here in Marion, spent some time in Ohio at Antioch College, actually worked at a radio station here in Marion in his early days, interned there back in the 1950s, and went on to become a gigantic celebrity, and his shows are still being played today. Legendary creator and writer of The Twilight Zone, host as well, Rod Serling. We're going to speak with his daughter, Jody, but before we do, let's listen to one of those classic introductions that Rod Serling did for so many years on The Twilight Zone.
Portrait of a Bush League Fuhrer named Peter Vollmer, a sparse little man who feeds off his self-delusions and finds himself perpetually hungry for want of greatness in his diet. And like some goose-stepping predecessors, he searches for something to explain his hunger and to rationalize why a world passes him by without saluting. The something he looks for and finds is in a sewer. In his own twisted and distorted lexicon, he calls it faith, strength, truth. But in just a moment, Peter Vollmer will ply his trade on another kind of corner, a strange intersection in a shadow land called the Twilight Zone.
Nobody did it any better than Rod Serling. We're so proud to be joined by his daughter, Jody Serling. Jody, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm honored to be able to do a little insight into my dad.
When you hear his voice and hear those shows, what's the first thing you think about?
I'm just really honored, not really surprised. I mean, I think he'd be more surprised that his legacy continues to live on, but it's just a really good feeling all over. It also brings a lot of sad memories for me as well, because he died so early, but he was an incredible genius and a great father.
You think he would be shocked that the Twilight Zone is still playing all over the world?
I do believe so. I think that, I don't think that he ever considered that this would be such a long-lasting, show. It has definitely stood the test of time because it deals with so many relevant issues from back then and it can still continue today. So I think, he'd be honored, surprised, and happy, and just like my whole family is.
Absolutely. What does it mean to you that the Twilight Zone has turned over 50 years old now?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
What does it mean to you that the Twilight Zone has turned over 50 years?
Well, like I said, I'm just really honored that this program has stood the test of time. It's never been off the air, and as you probably know, there's still TV marathons all the time, and it's also been shown in many foreign countries. And my dad would be honored and surprised at the longevity of this timely show.
What did you think of the program?
I really enjoy seeing my dad on TV. As a child, I never truly shared the extent of the excitement, until I became an adult. But I remember when it first aired, I was about 7 years old. And a few years later, I remember asking my dad what the show was really about. His explanations really confounded my 11-year-old brain. And my dad would describe the series as like grown-up fairy tales. And then I would ask him if there were animals in the series, and he would look at me and say that I was barking up the wrong tree. But then I would remember that he would also tell me that the show was about the mysteries of life that I would never learn in school, of course. And I kind of remember that sounded vaguely, rebellious and cool, and I remember the smile on my dad's face indicating that when he explained his reasonings of the Twilight Zone, he knew he had made a sale, and I could say goodbye to Lassie and make room for Daddy now.
Absolutely. When you thought about it when you were a child, and you think about it now, how have your opinions changed? When you watch an episode now, how is it different than then?
Different than then?
Yeah, because when you were...
I'm an adult now, and I have more visions into it. I understand the program more. It captivates my attention. There's just such a message there that relates to so much today that it just it's very intense for me, and I'm incredibly moved by many of the stories.
Do you have a favorite episode?
Oh yeah, I do. Really, the nostalgic ones are the ones that really move me, the ones that are going back in time, especially Walking Distance, Stop at Willoughby. The other ones that I thought were good were Time Enough at Last and The Eye of Beholder, In Praise of Pip, and The Mask. These were all stories that were conveying important messages.
What is it like being Rod Serling's daughter?
Well, I never felt that my father's attention was in short supply. He always made time for us. He was, so kind and had such a warmth that generated around all of us. I never felt there was any conceit from him, that he was just a proud, honest man, who wanted to entertain and motivate his audience. With like lasting thoughts and pertinent lessons that we will, carry with us forever. He did wear his heart on his sleeve, and his values and ethics definitely outshined almost everyone, in my opinion. My dad was a really great role model, and he taught us, about basic values, that you have to earn what you want in life and not to expect it to be handed to you like entitlement carved in stone. He would say to me, I remember all too well these words of wisdom that he conveyed, and that was, Jody, always be yourself, never live in anyone's shadow, or try to reap anyone else's successes or benefits. I think that's the message, that he gave me.
Is it hard to be a celebrity's child?
You know, that's a really interesting question. You know, you can make your life as you choose. My father did shelter us from the limelight, and we did not have a typical Hollywood child. I didn't feel we had a typical Hollywood childhood. But my dad used to say to me, and these words always seemed to generate in me, that he used to tell me that he had to put his pants on one leg at a time, like any father. So I grew up being my own self.
What kind of father was he?
Well, the first of my thoughts about my dad was that he was caring and incredibly funny. He always had this like childlike quality to him. He held on to the beautiful, innocent qualities that one is gifted as a child, and these qualities, you know, most adults, they leave behind in the past. But I remember my dad told me that what kept him young in mind and spirit was to hold on to those childhood values, and he came to us with love, and he was always helping people, particularly like the younger generation. He definitely believed in the younger generation and had a deep caring for them. He felt that they would be the voice of the future. I also believe that this is why he went into teaching, especially at the universities. But I also remember that my dad, he would draw the line at helping like deadbeats or lazy underachievers who thought that the world owed them a living. He felt the kind of people who kept on taking because it was a lot easier than facing a real world where they would be exposed, you know, for the incompetence that they actually were. My father did not have any tolerance for the human failings as greed, ingratitude, and hypocrisy. And, you know, he definitely had a massive, uncompromising integrity when it came to judging people and their own commitment to such basic values as honesty and simple sincerity.
Was he proud of the Twilight Zone?
I believe he was proud of it. I think he was tired, and that's why he did sell it out to CBS. But he did enjoy the fact that he did have creative control of the show. He started the Twilight Zone so he could write about and address the problems in society. And he did realize that he had to get a point across. It often meant him creating scripts that contained controversial messages and dialogue. He felt that, you know, it was criminal that writers were not...
Nope. Hello, Jody? Uh-oh. I think we might have lost her there. Well, hopefully we will get Jody Serling back here. You know what? That's what happens when you're doing live radio. You never know what's going to happen. So I tell you what, quick break here. Try to reconnect with Jody Serling and come back with hopefully much more here on WWGH Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back momentarily.
Talking about now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the tomb of King Tut, there's a chuck full of nuts and McDonald's. At the Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the styrofoam boxes go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised a wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
Chris and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
What would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. Yeah. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire.
I will do
anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. But well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 1210 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you here, 29 minutes past the hour, and we have reestablished our connection with Jody Serling, the daughter of television icon, creator of The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling. Jody, we had our own little Twilight Zone episode there ourselves.
We did. Did I say something?
Actually,
we were talking about my father writing The Twilight Zone and how he was able to get points across without having the networks, you know, stop what he was trying to write and censor it. So he, you know, would use the advantages of science fiction and fantasy. You know, the advertisers would approve it because they were, you know, saying that it took place in a fictional world. So he was able to get a lot of his points across by using this kind of mode. He was, you know, also proud of other things like The Requiem for a Heavyweight, Storm in Summer, The Comedian, Patterns, and other Playhouse 90 programs. And there were a few Night Gallery shows that were pretty good, and a short-lived series called The Loner with Lloyd Bridges. He did not feel that these scripts took more of... He did feel that these scripts took more of his time and energy. And I also believe that, in a way, he might have been somewhat upset that people only associated him with The Twilight Zone at times, because there was so much more to his writing.
Did he have a favorite episode?
Well, of course, he liked the nostalgic ones, the same ones that are my favorite, and The Family. Walking Distance, definitely. You know, Time Enough at Last, Stop at Willoughby, and In Praise of Pip. Nostalgic, sentimental ones that, you know, were a part of him that you could really see in them.
What was he most proud of in life?
Oh, boy. That's a real tough question, but I can answer it. Certainly his family, and he had wonderful close friends that gave him, you know, incredible joy. Also, our menagerie of animals. You know, his love of animals unequivocally. I also believe teaching young people at the schools and helping them give direction in their life. This certainly did give him much satisfaction and a sense of, you know, accomplishment as well.
Have you followed in his footsteps in any way?
Well, yes and no. I write privately about my animals, their life, and their loss. I do, as my father, have a desire to help people and care for them. I'm a retired registered nurse of 32 years, and I went into nursing when he was having his, right before, when he went into open heart surgery. And when we lost him, I realized that that was my calling, to become a registered nurse and take care of, you know, sick and dying patients. So I became a nurse. But I believe that I have my father's also fierce independence, and definitely his sense of humor. And I also wear my heart on my sleeve. But the truth is that no one will ever fit into my father's shoes. He used to tell us that on, you know, he was born on Christmas Day, and he entered the world unwrapped. And I believe there was a reason that he was born Christmas Day, and that in itself tells me how special he was.
When you think of your father today, what's the first thing that pops in your mind?
Well, I think of my father, who passed away too soon, 50 years. And he was just starting a whole new episode in his life with writing. He had so much to offer and give to society, and his, you know, incredible imagination has left such a pervasive and lasting influence on our society. He was a brilliant man who definitely had premonitions beyond our imagination. And I think of my dad as a loving, caring man, and there's not a day that goes by that memories of him don't float throughout my mind. And I got to tell you, I miss him so much. It's tough.
Yeah. What is Rod Serling's legacy?
I think that, you know, he had an ability to transform his ideas and his beliefs into extraordinarily and beautifully written stories. and the fact that his work is still pertinent today. I mean, the show's never been off the air. You know, what he's created are issues that extend over our generations, you know, issues such as racism and bigotry and prejudice that were relevant then and are still relevant today. He did feel that television was important and it could be an art form, and it, you know, had a responsibility to not only entertain but to illuminate social injustice. My dad believed that the role of a writer, and this is what he said, was to menace the public conscience. And throughout his life, he did use radio, television, and films as vehicles of social criticism. I believe he would have been disappointed in much of television today, though, like the mindless reality shows, the sitcoms. He would have enjoyed the history channels and public broadcasting and Discovery Channel, but mainly TV, no, he would not be into it. My mom, Carol Serling, who since the day my dad has died has really tried to protect and preserve the Rod Serling legacy, and, you know, let it be noted, not of fame and awards, but of a unique storyteller who knew how to deliver meaningful sermons wrapped in the cloak of science fiction entertainment.
Tell me something personal about your dad.
Well, my dad was, he was very vulnerable. He had a really hard time when he came home from the war, and he used writing as a vehicle for therapy for himself. He was incredibly nostalgic, and like the stories like In Walking Distance and Praise of Pip also reflected parts of my dad. You know, the pain and loss, not when he was over in the Philippines, his father had a heart attack, and he asked for early dismissal, and they couldn't get him out in time. And before he could make it home, his father had died. It was very traumatic on my dad. Also, the war was very traumatic. One of his best friends that saved him, my father got malaria like 13 times, and they were going to leave him behind because he was too weak to walk, like in the jungles, and this guy carried him through the marshes and everything, and then right before they were about ready to go home, they dropped some foods and parcels from an airplane, and it landed on his best friend's head and decapitated him. So there was just a lot of post-traumatic stress for him. Also, you know, when he came back home, his dad was gone, and, you know, he just wanted to go back in time and change everything and be with his dad. So there was a lot of pain and a lot of heartache, and that's where, like, the nostalgic theme comes so much in his stories. And every summer he would drive to Binghamton when we were out on the lake in New York, and it was like an hour trip, and he'd revisit his hometown, and he'd drive by his home where he grew up, and, you know, he'd take long evening strolls to the merry-go-round that he used to ride on when he was a little kid. And he would say about this in one of his stories when he was talking about Walking Distance, that it was just a wonderless, you know, bittersweet time of growing up. And he would talk about the feelings that he got and the mood that, you know, on the summer night, the remembrances of time before, you know, when he was little, and that's really what got this Walking Distance first story of him. But this is a, you know, pilgrimage my father would take every summer until his death. And like we talked about before, he held on to that childlike quality that he had as a boy, and he told me never to lose it, because that would be a part of death in myself. So, you know, I'm not sure, I think I went off on a tangent here, but, you know, I just felt that he died sad, because I think, you know, he had a fear of mortality, and I have a feeling that he didn't know if he was going to make it through the open heart surgery. So, you know, it's sad. I just feel that his life was taken from him and he wasn't ready to go.
You say he had this fear of mortality. Did he ever express where that came from?
Oh, yes, he did. Let's see, how do I describe this? Well, we come from a family with very bad heart disease, and this was definitely, you know, an ongoing concern for him, because he did have high blood pressure, and he did have a very stressful life, you know, in certain times when he was writing. But, you know, it was definitely an ongoing concern, but he didn't really verbalize it. I think he more internalized it. But, you know, denial can be a really lethal, malignant tool for coping. And I think this is what somewhat he did. You know, he just denied that something was going on with his heart when he had symptoms that should have been addressed.
We talked about him dying so young at 50 years old. What happened at the end? What exactly, kind of take me through the last few months of his life.
Well, he was out in California, and he had flown here in the spring of 1975, and he was supposed to be speaking at Elmira College, their graduation, and I remember he came to visit me, and I remember looking at him, and he had this, like, gray, ashy tone to his skin, and it just didn't seem right. Something told me something wasn't right, but I, of course, wanted to not deny my feelings, what I was observing, but I guess it was right after this speech, and can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, right after the speech in Elmira, he was doing the rotor tillering at the lake, and my mom saw him fall and clutch his chest, and they rushed him to the emergency room, and it was a heart attack, but it wasn't really serious, but it was just this county hospital. And then when they had him in the hospital observing him, I guess he was, you know, hooked up to the EKG, and it showed another heart attack. So we sent him with the ambulance to Strong Memorial Hospital in Rochester, which was more advanced. However, open-heart surgery in 1975 was still very brand new, you know, not like it is today where you're out in 3 days after open heart. But he had a massive coronary after the bypass, and they couldn't wean him off the heart-lung machine, and they had to take him off because you can't be on that machine too long because your vital organs start to shut down. So he died. I'll never forget, you know, the doctor coming by the hallway and emptying us with this, knowing that he had passed. And I think in a way he kind of knew. He said that he wasn't really afraid of dying, but he was afraid of missing all the people he loved. It's really hard to talk about it, you know?
Oh, certainly. I you know, do you remember the last conversation you had with him?
I do. Before he went in for the open heart, I was standing by him, and I remember saying, "Dad, it's going to make you whole again, you know? You're going to have a more quality life now. You're not going to have the chest pain." And he said, "Jody, just remember I love you." Mm. Those are the last words he told me.
What a great, you know, it's sad that he had to leave, but a good way, a nice way. When somebody passes away so young and so famous at that time, what was it like when it hit the news wires?
Oh, wow. I remember it. It wasn't a long time because we were driving home from Rochester and, trying to remember that we drove into the driveway at the lake because this was, you know, back east, and there were some people at the house that were, you know, people that were going to help us deal with this loss. And I remember looking at these roses that my dad had planted, and they were blooming the day that he died.
And, you know, they never bloomed again after the day that he died. But, you know, I remember going up to the field and, you know, talking to my dad and saying, "Dad, if you can hear me, just give me some kind of signal." And all of a sudden, these stars started falling out of the sky. It was just so, realistic. I just, I could tell he was there. You know, he was listening to me. But I still have a hard time with it. I've moved on with my life, but it's still, I miss him, and I feel like I would have had even more quality time with him, you know, if I had been older. Because growing up, I always wanted to be myself, and I didn't want to be associated as Rod Serling's daughter. I wanted to be my own self, because that's what he kept telling me. You know, find your pathway. Don't try to follow in someone else's footsteps. Do your own thing, what feels right. And I kind of shied away from the celebrity growing up, you know, atmosphere. And now when someone comes up and says, "Aren't you Rod Serling's daughter?" or "What was it like?" And, you know, I'm proud to answer it. I want to be recognized as his daughter, because now I've matured and I'm just really honored to know that he was my father. And I can still be myself, but still feel honored, you know?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about it here in Ohio because of Antioch College, and certainly even here in Marion, because he did spend some time here as a writer when he was an intern at a local radio station. And we even have some of his writings where he wrote some commercials while he was here. And I think there's even a little bit of voice of a story he did on D-Day. Remembrance of D-Day. Did he have any special connection to Ohio?
Yes. Well, we went back in the 60s, and he taught a half year at Antioch College. So we planted ourselves there for like 6 months. So it was a lot of teaching that he did at the college. So that's the time we left California for the winter and moved to Yellow Springs, Ohio, and that's what he was doing there, was teaching writing courses and things like that.
What was he like as a child growing up? What was his early childhood like from what you've learned?
My dad was a clown, liked to be the center of attention. Everyone that met him adored him. His high school teacher that stayed in his life for so long just said to him, you're going to make something of yourself. You are going to be special. And she'd tell him that all the time. But then he decided he wanted to go in the service before he did go to college, because that's what was driving him. That's what he said he needed to do. Maybe conquer fears. I'm not sure, you know, but I guess at that time a lot of men were enlisting into the service in those days. But, you know, it was very hard on him. But he told jokes. He was easygoing. He loved animals. We used to dress our animals up in people clothes. He was definitely attentive to my friends. We'd play games at the lake. He'd run around like a horse or put a lamp on his head. And then he had a best friend that did the same things with him. In fact, his best friend, Dick Berg, they would come over every Saturday and play gin rummy. And his friend had some phobias with animals, and my father was playing gin, and my dad was winning. And so, or my dad was losing, and I remember I went upstairs, I had pet rats, and I put one of the pet rats on the table to distract Dick, so he wouldn't win the cards with my father anymore. And my father literally almost had a heart attack, not literally, but he said, "That's my girl, Joe. Distract him with the rat," you know. And there was another story that he had to come out to California to do work when we were back east, and he brought me a pet rat on the airplane, because my rat had gotten loose, and he had it in a little cage. And the rat got loose on the airplane, and he leaned down and saw that it had gotten out of the cage. He didn't know what to do, because he didn't want to, you know, excite everybody in the airplane with this little rat running across the quarters. So So he got down on his hands and knees, and he was crawling down the corridor, pretending like he lost something. And then he gets back to his seat, and the rat crawled back in the cage. But when he told us this story, you know, he was crying with laughter. I mean, it was just, that's so my dad, you know.
He
just was lighthearted, loving, caring, and giving, but very strong on his feelings, you know, with prejudice and bigotry and hatred. And so he was definitely a man of different colors, but a wonderful dad.
His wife, your mother, Carol, is still with us. How would you describe their relationship?
Well, I think, you know, at times she was definitely his rock of Gibraltar. She definitely steered him in the right direction. You know, if he also read a lot of his scripts to her, so she was very helpful in his writing and directed him in the right direction. Sort of tried to tone him down if he was getting a little too excitable. I think it was hard on her. I mean, definitely, you know, being in the kind of position he was, you know, she didn't always get to have his quality time with him because he was so busy at times, but he was there if she needed him. But I think she's the one that's kept the program doing, you know, everything of my father's image, is she's kept it in such a good light. We've had a couple of people write books about my father that are totally incorrect. They didn't know my father. Most of them that wrote some of these books, they just lacked the knowledge of, you know, who my father was and what he believed in. And, you know, they left out his gift of being so incredibly nostalgic and funny and caring, but a lot of times they just wrote sensationalism to sell their products, you know, nothing more, nothing less. So there have been some books out that we were not happy with, but I don't think they've done that well. But we have had a couple of projects in the past that were very honorable. They did a PBS special several years ago. And then my mom and I were trying to work on my father had a script called Time Enough, Stops Along the Way, which was a story he had written but never sold it to CBS. So we had total control of this story, and J.J. Abrams wanted to make a miniseries out of it because J.J. Abrams was a real fan of my dad's. So my mom and a bunch of other people, you know, they were working on getting this project going, and unfortunately it didn't go. There was just circumstances that caused it to become dead, and that was another CBS deal that went dead years ago because of the same reasons. But there is a bio coming out right now that my mom's working on. It's in the baby steps, but it's going to be fabulous. So that's what we're working on right now.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up because she's gone now. But for years, there was a lady who worked in radio here, started in 1940. Her name was Madge Cooper, and she was at the radio station.
Oh, I remember that name.
Yes, she
yeah,
was.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I just remember the name.
They stayed friendly. She lived to be 99.
Wow.
Yeah, so she passed away in 2009, but I talked to her about Rod because she was really the only one left who had been there when he was there. And I remember when she went into the Broadcasters Hall of Fame, she said Rod Serling did work at our station, but when she saw Twilight Zone, she said, I couldn't imagine that coming from his head. What is the biggest misconception about your father that these books perpetrate and...
Okay, I'm not following.
Well, I think most people see him as just Twilight Zone. They see him as science fiction. And I think Madge was saying she saw him as so much more, that he was a great...
Well, that's why he did write other things, that he didn't have to use science fiction as a vehicle to get a point across. I mean, I think that's why, you know, you saw Patterns and you saw... Storm and Summer, about a little black boy being introduced into a white society. Then there was, can't remember his name. The little black boy that was hung. Tillett.
Oh, Emmett Till.
Anyway, he had to change that whole script because the networks didn't like the fact that he was using a black boy who was hung, and he had to change it to a Mexican, and it just, that's where he got frustrated because he wasn't able to express his point across because he wasn't using science fiction as a vehicle for communication. So, he did write other things that weren't like The Twilight Zone, and as a matter of fact, before his heart attack, he and my mom were going over Italy to do the screenplay for The Salamander. He was starting a different venture in life, but there was lots of sides to him. Like, he was nostalgic, he was very determined to help society. He'd be horrified at what's happening today. I can tell you that. I'm not going to get political, but he'd probably leave the country. So there were different assets of his personality that came out in different writings.
We're chatting with Jody Serling, the daughter of Rod Serling. We have about 6 minutes left here. Jody, he was born Christmas Day, 1924. He would be...
1924.
Yes. He would be 93 years old right now. If he had made it, where do you think he'd be today? What would he be doing?
Well, I think he'd be taking a different course in writing, like going over and doing the screenplay for Salamander. I think he'd be more politically inclined to be involved in politics. I don't think he'd run for an office, but I think he'd feel very strongly about what's happening to our country and, you know, the fears that are coming out, like when monsters are due on Maple Street and how that kind of fear can just, you know, exacerbate and make people crazy. So I think he'd address things like, you know, politics, and I think he'd be talking about issues of bigotry and prejudice, and I don't know if he'd stay on the science fiction mood right now. I think he would have done more stuff that's real.
Being that it was the 1950s, most people did not have movie cameras, and if they did, they usually did not have sound. There is a lot of your father recorded on video and television. When you see him up on the screen, even today, is it like seeing your father?
Yes, because I know that's just part of him. He's not the man that stands in front of the TV in black and white, you know, rigid and saying something, because I know the man behind it, and I know the man, and I know the person that he is. So I see all different facets of him, and one is being radio or TV person, but I also see the father and the love that I have for him. So it's a lot of things I see.
It's so interesting because he is loved by so many people who never got the chance to meet him. How does it make you feel that people just, they love him? They love him to this day.
Like I said, you know, when I was younger, I didn't really care to hear about it because I wanted to be myself and I didn't want someone coming up and saying, hey, what's it like having a famous father like that? And I remember doing an interview after Dad passed, somebody came up and said, what's it like? And I said, you know, and I remember what my dad said. He puts one leg of the pants on one at a time or whatever that he would say. But today, you know, I'm over that. I'm just so honored, and I miss him, and I'm sorry that I didn't get to appreciate him as much as I could have because I'm older now and I understand more about him. But I love him to death. And I wish there was some way that he knew that you know, we were all down missing him and loving him.
How did he react? He had that philosophy about being well-known, but when people approached him for autographs or pictures or whatever they did in those days, how did he deal with that?
Well, you know, I remember we went to, I think it was Disneyland or something, and I was with my sister and maybe some friends, and somebody came up, and my dad wanted that quality time with the family. He, you know, I think at times he was honored to sign autographs, but this was why I didn't like the fame, because if he did get involved in conversation with somebody that was a fan, it took that quality time away from me. So I think that's why I was the way I was. But I remember somebody came up to him and asked if he was Rod Serling, and my dad said, no, I just look like him. And then I remember my sister running up to the guy and saying, that really is Rod Serling. And I was upset, because this was his time with the family, you know, even though I think he enjoyed, you know, the fame to some extent. But I think he also wanted the downtime with his family where he could just be, dad.
Absolutely. Did he have any, we know his father died young. Was his mother around? Did he have any siblings?
Yes, he had an older brother that was 8 years older, who also was a writer. He did The President's Plane Is Missing and Left Seat and some other things. My uncle exceeded the lifespan of the Serling family. He didn't die till 92. All the Serling families, because of the cardiac disease so prominent, all died in their 50s. But my uncle managed to, you know, live to be 92. His mom was alive for a while. I think she had a stroke when she passed, and I was little when she passed, but that's the family that he had, and you know, cousins and things like that, but not a big family.
Do you have anything of your father's that you have kept over the years?
Oh, I do. I have the original mask that were used in the Twilight Zone, the actual pieces of the, I don't know what they're made of, that they formed the faces for on the mask, and I have them in a little cabinet. I have some speeches of my dad's that he did, you know, at the different universities, and some other memorabilia that my mom gave me that I will hold on for my life. But my biggest thing is my memory of him.
Absolutely. And because of that, all these years later, my final question, because we do still remember him, we're talking about him today. I think they'll be talking about him 100 years from now. How do you think he would like to be remembered?
Well, I remember in one of his last interviews with Linda Burvell, the question she asked him was, 100 years from now, what would you like to be honored as? And he said, the most honorable position that I could ask for is that someone could say, oh yeah, he was a writer.
Mm. A very modest man. Jody, I can't thank you enough for coming on today to share your memories of your dad.
Well, I'm so honored and pleased to have done this. I really am.
Thank you, Jody.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Jody Serling, the daughter of legendary Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
9-5, webpage.